Welcome to On Par with Maury Povich. She's advised presidents, prime ministers, she's built brands, she's helped shape the global conversation around tech and culture and storytelling. But Maha Abulanein's greatest power did it on her terms. Yeah. How's that? By betting on herself over and over again. So today on Par, we talk reinvention, identity, and the rules of self-reliance. Welcome.
Maury, thank you so much for having me.
In fact, we're going to talk a lot about the rules of self-reliance.
Yes.
Which probably, you know, is your moniker. You believe in that more than anything else.
Yeah, I think it's the thing that helped me. Every time I got my back up against a wall, I couldn't rely on other people to help me. I actually realized that the answers were within me. And I wrote this book so I can help other people figure out, you know what? You can rely on yourself if you do a few things that are at your fingertips that everyone has access to.
I'm going to get into that, the seven rules and everything else, but I want to talk about you.
Oh.
You're Egyptian.
I'm 100% Egyptian.
And you grew up in Mankato, Minnesota.
I grew up in a very small town in Minnesota where, you know, everyone around me had, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes and German and Swedish descent. And I was the only brown girl in my class. It was a very unique situation I grew up in, but I love Minnesota and I grew up and I had a great childhood there.
And your father ended up going to Egypt.
Yes.
And so you went to Egypt.
Yeah. So both of my parents got married, moved to the U.S. to go to school. My parents went to Ann Arbor, Michigan and Illinois.
Your father was the dean at
Mankato
State?
My dad was the dean of the business school. And then after living in the U.S. for about 35 years, raising me and my sister, my parents decided it was time to go home. It was time to go back to Egypt. And I was 27 years old.
And you didn't know the language?
I don't speak Arabic. I don't have any friends. I don't have any network whatsoever in Egypt. It's like you moving to Egypt, Maury, right? You're just fresh off the boat. I land in Egypt. And I'm like, I need to find a job. I need to figure out what I'm going to do with myself. I had a great job at General Mills, working in sports marketing, working for the IT brands, Wheaties, Cheerios.
You thought that was going to be your future?
Yeah, and I thought I was going to have this consumer products marketing career, and I moved to Egypt and I can't find a job. And I try to apply at P&G and Coca-Cola and Unilever, Pepsi, any American company that's in Cairo, so I can get the similar job I had to General Mills. I can't find a job. And the only job I could find was I got offered to be the secretary for a billionaire.
So like an office manager.
An office manager was literally the
title.
And
you thought, beneath me.
I said, no way. I'm not doing that. That job's beneath me. I have a master's degree. I was working for this IT company. I am not going to sit outside someone's office and answer phone and file papers and get coffee. Like, I'm too overqualified for this role. And I was like pretty upset about it. And I went home and I told my dad that I got this opportunity. And he was like, this is the best thing that could ever happen to you. You just moved here. You don't have any friends. You don't have any network. You don't have any relationships. Anyone that needs to get to him has to go through you. This is a blessing. If I were you, I would go tomorrow immediately and take that job no matter what they offer you. And much to my chagrin, I went the next day and I accepted that job and it changed my life forever.
Stop right there. I led the same part of my life as you did.
Mm-hmm.
The exact same thing. I just get married. I'm right out of college. I want to get into television. I want to be on the air as a reporter.
Yep.
So bad. That's all I wanted to do. Couldn't get a job. Nobody would. First of all, it was a catch 22. Back then, in order to be in TV, you had to be in radio.
Yep.
So I applied to radio. Yeah, but you can't have a job here unless you have experience. Yeah, but what? I mean, you got to do something. I get hired beneath me as an assistant to the publicity director at a 5,000-watt radio station. Best thing that ever happened to me. Hung around the newsroom. The news director got pissed off because I was there all the time. But it wasn't my job. Finally said, if you're bothering us so much, we might as well make you a reporter.
Make you put you to work.
Same thing. get in the door anyway.
Get in the door anyways. And I'd be like, I sat outside his office and then I was like reading every piece of paper going in and out of his office. I was like, after 3 or 4 months, I was nagging him. Like, let me do something. Let me sit in the meeting and write notes. Let me come with you to this thing. I'll be just whatever I could do. And because I was such a nag, he's like, fine, I'll give you something to do that's outside of your job. Because I'm like, I need to do this job really well. I need to be a pleasure to work with. I need to network. I need to meet everybody coming in and out of his office. I wanted everyone to say, Ma has a pleasure to work with. We love her. Like, I wanted to build relationships. And that's where I learned how to network.
So yeah. the first rule of self-reliance is what we just talked about.
Yeah. One of the rules of self-reliance is how to be a long-term player and build relationships. You have to know how to connect with people. I can't come to you, Maury, and say, oh, you've had an incredible career. You build a lifetime of relationships in your network. Can I borrow those? I want to teach people how to do that for themselves. Right. Because it's valuable to have your own relationships, your own network, that you rely on yourself to do it. So I don't have to farm out and ask other people for help.
I had the same experience when I finally got to television after about 4 years in radio. And I got, and he became my patron, this general manager. He says, you look like you're more than interested in just, you know, being a sports reporter or a talk show host. I said, I want to learn about this business. Mm-hmm. He said, okay, my door is open. I don't care whether I'm meeting with the sales department, the promotion department, the program department. I don't care if I'm talking to the president of the entire chain of stations. You can sit there and watch what I do. If you want to learn this business.
And imagine how much the experience you got from that.
Have no idea.
It's eye-opening.
As I went on to be successful at big shows at Fox and at Universal, I was the only talent that they would take me on sales calls because I knew all kinds of parts of the business.
You knew the process. I mean, for me, also, I got to sit outside the chairman's office. I got to understand how the business works. Who's related to what, so that I knew, which is one of the second rules of the book, is where to create value. Like, I have to learn his business inside and out so I can figure out where could I say, huh, this is a role where I can play, you know, a meaningful role, or this is a job where I can create value. So it was great listening. I got, when am I ever going to sit that close to the sun, i.e. a chairman or a billionaire, to learn from him?
So where did you go from there?
Well, I started as his assistant. I worked on the largest IPO in the history of Egypt, the largest acquisition in the history of Egypt, because he put me into jobs and put me into positions to win. I ended up as his business partner. I asked him, I said, I'd love to build a communications firm in the Middle East. Also something I wasn't qualified to do. Like, I'm not a CEO, I'm not an entrepreneur, but I just knew communications and storytelling, and I built that kind of expertise. And we opened Weber Shandwick in the Middle East. It's a global PR firm. We opened up 18 offices for them. I then went on to run communications and public policy for Google in the Middle East. I started the day the Arab Spring broke out in Egypt. Long story there. Then I went on to launch Netflix in the Middle East and served them for 5 years. Worked in the office of the ruler of Dubai and consulted for 3 undersecretaries of state for public diplomacy.
Did you ever learn Arabic?
I did learn Arabic.
How long did it take?
Probably like in my 3rd or 4th year, I felt comfortable, fluent, where people were like, oh, you have an accent. But now I speak fluently and I can get along, and people don't know that I was born in Mankato, Minnesota.
I've been to Egypt.
You have?
Yes.
I know.
I was in the company of the famed archaeologist, Sahi
Hawass. I've seen.
And I did a big special on us rediscovering a mummy.
Yes, I've seen it.
On the Fox Network, big primetime show.
Yeah, he's legendary. He's still around.
He is.
Yeah, he's like our Crocodile Dundee, the famous hat. And any heads of state or anybody who goes to Egypt, Princess Diana famously was seen, Jimmy Carter, Obama, right. all the celebrities who go get a tour by Dr. Zahi Hawass. I've seen your special. It's wonderful.
And the best part about it was the next day, in the big daily Egyptian paper, there's a picture of me.
You.
That was remarkable. It was great. It was terrific.
Egypt is a magical and special place.
Like, it sure is.
It is, you know, coming from the U.S., I moved to Egypt. It's a third world country. You know, traffic is bad. Internet wasn't that stable. You know, it's 100 million people live in Cairo. You know, it's a far cry from the 30,000 people in Mankato, my hometown. So it was a lot to get used to a big city, but like, it's got a pulse. It's got a fever. It's got a traffic.
It's,
like,
it's big.
Yeah. And it's got an energy
Cairo
to it.
Is huge.
Yeah. That's culturally, it's infectious.
So how did you, at what point did you end up being an intern at CBS?
Yeah. So when I was at, I went to school at Mankato State University. And I got my master's in communications. And so in between, you know, semesters, I took a job at CBS. My first day on the job was President Clinton at the time was coming to do a convention. The DNC was in Minneapolis. That was like one of my first stories I got assigned to. And back then you're doing everything. You're carrying the camera.
Sure.
You're, you know,
one
laying down
band.
Audio. You're schlepping. Like, this isn't a glamorous, you know, anchor job. I'm like an intern who's schlepping everything. And I got my first story on camera that I got to do a package for, a story for, was a Lotto fever had hit. And I was doing at the convenience store at a 7-Eleven interviewing people about what they would do with the money if they won. It's a very funny clip. We'll have to share it with everyone. But that's where I fell in love with communications and storytelling. Being in that newsroom where something was coming in off the wire and we would have to figure out how to package it and broadcast it and tell it to the world.
It's infectious.
That excited me to no end.
Yeah.
That's when I learned the value of who's your audience, how to tell a story, how do we say it? If it's bad news, how do you say it in a way that's going to be, you know, not put fear in the hearts of the audience? Or if it's good news, do we lead with that? You know, just thinking through storytelling and audience development. I mean, this was like 1995, 1996.
Right.
This is back in the day. But I loved it. And I had a full circle moment when I was on with CBS News with Gil King and Nate Burleson.
That.
Yeah. And they put up the clip of me working as an intern. I'm like, you know, it's a full circle moment. I grew up watching Dan Rather every
sure.
night, like our family dinner. We'd have dinner and watch the news.
That was it.
Is what we did. And I always, one of my little girl was like, I want to be doing live stand-ups from the pyramids. Like, this is Maha reporting live from CBS News. Like, I was going to work for CBS. That was my goal. That was my whole thing. And so.
And then you went to Egypt.
And then I did go to Egypt.
So what was it like working at Google? I mean, and Netflix for that. I mean, those are, you know.
Big tech giants.
Juggernauts.
Yeah, so I joined Google. I accepted the job to work at Google the day the Arab Spring broke out in the Middle East. And that was the day when they were having a lot of protests and they
sure.
overthrew the Egyptian president. And not knowing that the guy sitting next to me, the marketing manager of Google, was, you know, really part of that whole Facebook, you know, anonymous page. But Google's the kind of company that is exactly what you think of. It's everyone around you is smart. Everything is fast paced. You are on the cutting edge of what's now and next in not just tech, but in people's lives. It was an enormous learning opportunity for me. I was working for them at their Dubai office. So I'd go to the office like 8:30 or 9. We, by 5 or 6, London would be up, Europe would be up. And then by 6 to midnight, Mountain View, California. So you were working enormous hours. Like, the way they make it easy for you.
So what's the
time zone difference is like 10 hours between
10 hours between Mountain View
and Dubai. Yeah. So I was working some pretty long hours, like daily until like 11 o'clock midnight every day.
I mean, their 9 a.m. is your 9 p.m.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was easily up until midnight.
All night.
And yeah, working very long hours. But like, you're in a thrilling moment. I helped launch YouTube in the Middle East at the time. We launched Google Maps, which didn't have in Street View. Like, we were in a very unique period of time. This is 2010, 2011, 2013, where all these new products were being launched in the Middle East. And I think after the Arab Spring, there was a lot of interest in Catalyst for Change and internet freedom and economic freedom and how can we put businesses online. And it was an exciting time to be a startup or to be a coder. And it was the early rise of when, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs became part of the regular vernacular in society.
Okay, I want to get to the rules.
Okay.
We've started the first one.
Yes.
You know, when you started as an office manager.
Yes.
Be a value creator.
Yes.
So you preach adding value
yep.
before asking for anything. How do you do that? How does that become a
yeah.
core practice?
So I think, I mean, it starts with a very simple question for me is how can I help? Like, when I meet somebody, Maury, I think about listening to what do they care about. It doesn't matter what I care about. I have to think, like, what do you care about? And so I listen. And then I try to figure out what's one thing I can pull or a string I can pull where I can bring value. Can I solve a problem for you? Can I introduce you to somebody that's meaningful to you? Can I send you something interesting that's helpful for your business? If you can find ways to create value for people, they're going to keep you around. And I find that a lot of...
So they should go to people and say, how can I help you?
Help you, yeah. And I talk a lot about a lot of the people I encounter, a client I want to get or someone I want to meet. I don't go in there asking for something. I'm like, okay, I got to figure out how I can add value to them without them asking for it. And then when they see my intentions, my delivery, my results, they're going to go, she's smart. I'm going to keep her around. She's being proactive. She's not asking for something in return. And she's trying to genuinely create value for me because it's good business or because it makes good sense.
You also say the third rule.
Yes.
Don't be a waiter.
So much time in our
waiter,
lives.
Waiter, W-A-I-T-E-R.
Yes. You're not being a waiter, Maury. You decided to create your own podcast.
Yes.
You could either wait for someone to come to me and say, hey, I'd like you to be on my network and be right on my show. Or you can go create your own platform, your own brand, your own podcast. That is the essential.
So a self-starter. Got to be a self-starter.
Yeah, like a lot of people are waiting. I'm waiting for more money in the bank account. I'm waiting to lose 10 pounds. I'm waiting because I don't want people to judge me. I'm waiting for permission to do something. I'm waiting because I fear failure. I don't want people to think, well, who does she think she
fear
is?
Fear of failure. It's fear of failure. It just rules too many people's lives.
Yeah, and it's like a lot of people don't want to do something because they don't want people to wonder, like, well, what are our friends going to say? Well, it's your life. It's your life.
And it's okay to fail.
Failure is not the opposite of success. Failure is part of success. The only things I learned in my life when I grew is when I failed. I've been fired from jobs.
Yeah, so
I've had setbacks.
Yeah.
And those things teach you.
And like, I tell everybody, it's not the act that you're afraid of. You're afraid of how you will feel when it happens.
Yeah, and I just don't want to feel that way anymore.
Right.
I interviewed after I worked at Google. I was at Google for a long time. And before I went to Netflix, there was this huge job opportunity for me at Facebook. Facebook was going to give me Middle East and Africa and Turkey. So it was like a bigger remit, more offices, more team, bigger scale. I was like, a lot of people at Google had gone to Facebook. I was like, dream job, nice transition, go from one tech company to the next. I was so successful at Google. I felt this was going to be a great transition for me. And I didn't get the job. And I had 4 interviews. The first 3 I nailed. The last one was with someone from Africa. I didn't really do my homework about that market. And I failed the interview and I didn't get the job. And I went home that day going, like, I never want to feel that way again.
Yeah.
How can I prepare? How can I ask questions? How can I be more curious so that I don't feel that bad? Like, I missed that opportunity to get that job. And I thought my tech career is over. And then I end up getting even a better job than the one I just missed out on. But I never will go into an interview again with a guest, with a candidate, for a job without doing my homework.
Absolutely.
It was part of that process that I had to learn it the hard way.
You also say unlearn.
Yes.
Boy, it's tough to unlearn because we all think that we're a product of our experience. So it's very tough to unlearn what we think we've experienced.
Yeah, ego gets in the way. We think we know everything, but times are changing. We have to unlearn the way we learn things, that we have to unlearn the way that we perceive things to be. It used to be where you went to school decided who you were going to become. That's not true anymore.
I have to unlearn as to where I get my information.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a really good one.
Because now there are all other kinds of platforms that were never around before. And so I have, guess what? It's just not the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal anymore.
It's true.
It's Politico.
Creators.
And it's all these other sites, podcasts. I mean, you have to unlearn what you thought you needed.
Yeah, and the reason I put it as a rule in the book is I think so much of what, you know, being curious about the world around you is important. But you have to be willing to let go of things that are no longer serving you. And sometimes it's hard to change our opinions on things because it's how we grew up. It's what we learned. It's what we were taught. But being able to evolve and to open yourself to new thinking and relearn new things, I think is critical. I'm 55. I could quit my job today and find a completely different career because I have access to the internet to learn something new. And I talk about in this rule about investing in yourself. How can you spend 15 minutes a day on a walk and a podcast learning something? Learning from YouTube, which is free. Learning from podcasts, which are free.
You also say, and it's something you're only as good as your reputation. So therefore, use it as currency.
100%. So a lot of people think, I have a reputation. I can't do anything about it. I'm like, your name is the only thing you actually own. What do you do to invest in it? What do you do to protect it? What do you do to grow it? It's like money. It's very, very valuable. And everyone talks about building your personal brand. It's about self-promotion and look at me, I know things. And I'm like, it's not about self-promotion. It's about your idea promotion. Everyone right now, everyone listening to this show, listening to this podcast, needs to be intentional about how they show up in the world. Because if you're not doing it, I can guarantee someone's doing it for you and it's not what you want. It's how you show up at work. Are you a team player? Are you a collaborator? Are you a good listener? It's how you show up online. When people Google you, are they finding what you put there or are they finding what other people put there?
Yeah. You also talk about, which is very difficult these days, you want to be a long-term player.
Yes.
You want to play the long-term game when everybody wants everything so quickly.
Now, yeah. I always talk about like we want to tap to pay and get out of the store. We want to download the whole season right now, right? But what about not doing something for someone because you're expecting something in return? I know it's so hard. I don't want to put myself out there and do favors and make introductions and do things for other people. What are they going to do for me? What has carried my career, what has carried me and my team and the way we operate is we think really long term. Like we're willing to put deposits in other people's trust banks because we know that keep making deposits in people's trust banks, that one day if we need it, we can make a withdrawal.
Ah, well, that's a good analogy. I like that.
Because you have to think about not doing tit for tat for people. That short term thinking, it won't serve you. Because people will know you as the hit and run person or the person that's always asking for favors or the person who only shows up when they want something.
And the last one, which I think could be the most difficult.
It is the hardest.
Live with no regrets. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot, everyone in life has challenges. Nobody is immune to problems in their life or things that they face or setbacks that happen to them. My mother got MS when I was 14. I was taking care of her since I was a child. I was essentially the parent in that relationship.
And your father developed ALS.
And my father got ALS. And I was like, at one point, both of my parents needed full-time care. Two parents.
Knowing, by the way, your father is going to die.
Yeah, and his was a terminal disease. They basically gave him a year to live. And your body's in a coffin when you have ALS. You're fully aware of what's happening, and it starts at the bottom and works its way up. And, you know, I could have regretted having to be the full-time caretaker, making all their medical decisions. I'm not out having fun with my friends every night because I'm at home taking care of my parents and dealing with the nurses and the trachs and the feeding tubes and the changeovers. Those were hard days. But I'm fortunate that it happened to me because it taught me a lot and it shaped who I am today. I have more empathy, I think, than if I hadn't gone through that. I'm more patient as a person. I know anyone who's been a caretaker knows how much patience it takes to put other people first before yourself. You learn a lot about perspective. You know, I can.
And it's very difficult to do if you had lived your life, you know, as it's all about me. I'm out there.
Yeah.
It's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
How I'm going to live. And now you're faced with your two loved ones needing your care.
Yeah, and making all their medical decisions and paying for all their medical bills and just all of the burden that does come with such a responsibility, but also it's emotionally taxing. And so when I talk about living with no regrets, like, I always used to just say to myself, this is my time to do this. There'll be other times for me to do other things that I care about doing. But for now, this is what's meant for me. And I'm going to try to not regret this and learn from it in the future and take the lessons that I'm learning from this and teaching my family around me, like how important it is that we show up for each other. And I feel like everyone has a story like this in their life of turning a setback into a comeback or something that's happened to you that might seem like it's the end of the world and very sad, but it can be something that you can turn into a teachable moment that matters.
What haven't you done that you want to do?
I really wanted to be on your show. I'm so excited to be here. So let's start with that. I just want to continue to help people. I think a big thing that I care about is helping people build their personal brands. So it's not necessarily for CEOs and celebrities and athletes, but like the dog mom, the real estate agent, the solopreneur. How can I help them find their voice? How can I help them use the internet to make money and to build a livelihood for them and their families? And I just feel like being good at storytelling can be really important, not because it just connects you with people, but you can build a livelihood from it. And that's the thing I'm passionate about, helping scale to as many people as possible.
Right. Well, your story is remarkable.
Thank you.
And I thank you. So, and these 7 rules, I mean, they're spot on. And I think that I don't know the rules. I never knew the rules, but I do relate to a lot of them. It's really good.
Thank you. It's practical.
Yeah. All right. So, we're going to go to the 19th hole now.
All right. Can't wait.
All right. You're a tennis player.
I am a tennis player, but we're going to golf.
Yeah. But by the way, I will tell you this. I've played with a lot of athletes.
Yep.
There's one kind of sport that these athletes in tennis are able to go to golf easier than many other sports. Better than football, better than basketball. Baseball is pretty good too, but tennis players, I mean, I've played with champion tennis players who just became addicted to golf and they became very good.
Okay, so there's hope for me. I can.
Oh,
I've played around before, yeah, but okay. I'm not good.
So
I'm
we'll
not,
go to the putting green.
We'll go to the putting
19th green. And you can ask me a question.
Or two or three. I've been dying to ask you some
questions.
Well,
I don't know if I'll be honest, but we'll see.
All right. So, Maury, I talk a lot about investing in yourself and being a lifelong learner.
Yeah.
You have a new show now.
Yes.
What's the one thing that you learned recently?
You know, it's not that I've learned anything new. I've learned to rejoice in my storytelling.
Oh, I love that.
And the fact that, you know, I've always thought of myself as a storyteller. And now I'm kind of back to the roots of when I did it as a reporter and a local talk show host and not these kind of edgy shows that the Maury Show turned into. And so I'm kind of relearning my storytelling.
Yeah, and it's fun.
Yeah, and it's great. It's terrific. And, you know, it's interesting. I like doing the podcast.
Yeah, the making of.
The making.
The process.
Yes. Yeah.
That's key.
You know what I don't like?
What?
Make up this outside promotion, that all the ancillary
You like
crap.
To be in the kitchen doing
yeah,
like the real
exactly.
storytelling work.
Don't you?
Yeah, I love that. The best part about it.
Yeah.
I talk a lot about reinventing myself because sure. I had to, went to 27, had to like start over, came back to the U.S. at 50.
Wow.
Don't have any friends, been gone for 23 years, don't have any networks, had to like reinvent myself again. You're reinventing yourself now through this show.
There you go.
What's all that right. been like?
Well, it's good. I mean, it's fun. Okay. Just, okay. You got, yeah, that's, you got good. Watch this. Oh.
Oh, I was going for the middle one.
That's okay. Go. For,
I didn't line it up probably properly.
That's all right.
Are you going to hit one? Or?
Well, I'll hit one if you, unless you make one.
Oh, yes! I got it! I did one! All right, yeah, your turn.
My turn.
Me how you do it.
Okay, I don't know.
I think I had too much backswing on that one.
You think so?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There, that's
oh,
how
my
you
Lord,
do it.
What happened?
You gotta know how you do
it. I'll this. Do one more.
Do you golf every day? Every week?
I.
How often?
I have no excuses. I play golf maybe 3 times a week.
You do?
Yeah.
Fun.
And then I practice another couple of days a
well,
week.
Yeah. This
That's
works.
Enough.
It's good.
Anything else you want to ask? Or is that it?
No, actually, I talked about a little bit on the show about how I want to focus on helping people build their personal brands, right? Your name is everything, right? Your name is everything. So when I told my family I'm going to meet Maury Povich, like, that's a name everyone recognizes.
Yeah.
And
you were the OG. You were the OG building your personal brand.
It was all by accident. I never expected it, and I think it. You know what I think it is? I think I touched a lot of people, and I never realized it. And I think maybe that was the success was. I never really took myself seriously. Mm-hmm. I took the job seriously. Mm-hmm. I took the work seriously. I took what I did seriously, but not myself.
So important.
Yeah.
And it carries you.
Yeah, it does. Good to
so
see
happy
you.
To be here. Thank you, Maury. Thank you for having me today. Thank you.
If you've had as much fun as I did, make sure you subscribe to On Par with Maury Povich on YouTube. And tap that little bell so you don't miss a thing. And if you like to listen on the go, we're on Apple, Spotify, everywhere you get your podcast. Hit that follow button. I'll be back with more before you know it. On Par with Me, Maury Povich, is brought to you by Mopo Productions, A Better Life Media, and Radley Studios. With executive producers, me, Maury Povich, Holly J. Mirabella, and Christian Thompson. Supervising producer, Mike Bournazian. And directed by Mark Leibowitz.